Next up,
Dirty Plays.
Everybody's ready to go. He's ready to go. I'm ready to go. And you're ready to go.
Boom shakalaka.
Hello, and welcome to Dirty Plays. I'm your host, Baby, and the Core Four is here today. Wait.
Wait,
I'm not Baby.
Where is Baby?
Hillbilly. Hillbilly couldn't make it tonight. Yeah. I tried to do the intro the best I could, but I sound nothing like that Hillbilly.
Put on your tinfoil hats for this question, because I've been wanting to ask you this all day. And I think Eric's mysterious disappearance tonight may somehow be involved. The Price Hill monkey escape, real or hoax?
No.
Do we think it's real?
100% real.
I don't think it's a conspiracy theory, but I do think there are live-ass monkeys out there running around right now.
How have they not found them yet? Or found traces of them?
Sure.
This needs to be on like some local news station 24/7. I want around the clock coverage, because if you're telling me that there are five monkeys running around Price Hill that are, according to reports, as big as a garbage can, how do we not have any evidence of this yet?
Wild,
and they're wild animals. They're good at hiding themselves.
They're up in trees, dude, just hanging out. I heard they were like somewhere in the cemetery. That cemetery's pretty big.
Yeah, they were in a cemetery. I saw some of the footage that someone shot. I think it's the only footage we have, and it's really blurry. It's like one of those Bigfoot videos, but. It does look like five primates up in a tree. Like the way the shapes look like they're sitting, it doesn't look like, well, and also the size of them. I'm like, it's probably not a bird. Turkeys sometimes get up in trees, but definitely didn't look like that. It's wild, though. It's wild.
Monkeys up in trees, dude. Fucking people spending their stimulus checks in all the right ways, but then letting it out the house.
That's the best part, is like somebody's got a private zoo in Price Hill in their house, which is cracking me up.
I
think Eric might be out there hunting them. I think he might be trying to capture them.
I guess what's bothering me is that there's no way somebody owns five monkeys and nobody else knows about it, and nobody is like willing to be like, yeah, it's these guys' monkeys.
Well, only certain primates are allowed to be owned as exotic pets in Ohio. So
sure, I know nobody's trying to get their friend arrested, but like somebody's gotta have some idea. I guess there's probably people out looking for them. Sneakily paid Eric off to do it.
Oh yeah,
he's out there hunting. Sweet Jesus.
Yeah, according to one eyewitness's descriptions, their arms were really long, hanging down, skinny arms. I'm guessing chimpanzees. I'm guessing there's five chimpanzees on the loose. That's so awesome.
They're probably getting close to my backyard at this point. They're still running around.
Dude, what would you do if you like get up tomorrow and try to go to your car and there's just a chimp sitting on your hood?
Right. To snap a picture and call off work.
Probably, yeah. Close my garage door, invite him inside.
Yeah, dude.
See if he wants to watch the Masters.
That's really why I would call off work tomorrow. We'll get to that later.
Yeah, we'll get to that. I've got some thoughts on Thursday's and Friday's action of the Masters. But Let's talk about a little March Madness action. Do you guys watch any of the Final Four?
Sad to say that I didn't watch much of it. I flipped on the games as I was going to bed, but it was way past my bedtime. I was asleep before halftime.
How I watched UCLA Gonzaga until halftime. I don't know how I decided at halftime.
Oh.
This game's it was amazing before halftime. So yeah. It's just that's how little I really cared about college basketball this year. It's like this is the best game I've seen in years.
Yep.
But I don't care still. So
I'm the same way.
I mean, it also started at like 9:30. So you were looking at watching that game, investing until midnight. I think I went to bed like past midnight because that game went to OT. But that game was, yeah, like you said, one of the best basketball games I've seen in years. It was an instant classic where both teams almost played perfect games and just kept trading blow for blow. I think at one point, it wasn't even like that deep into the second half. They mentioned that there were already 17 lead changes. Like it was just back and forth, back and forth. And honestly, it made me so stoked. I was like, I don't even want to watch the final now because it can't be better than what I just watched. And it wasn't. I did watch the final as well. The only game of the like final four round that I didn't watch was Houston Baylor, and I'm happy I didn't. But that UCLA Gonzaga game was incredible.
Yeah. You see how like that Mick Cronin led team, how they win that gritty game against Michigan the game prior, where they win what like with 52 points or something like that, and then they turn around and they're able to put up what was it like 90 or 88 or something like that in the game against Gonzaga. But do you feel like we talked about this in the last episode about how because they were the UCLA that they got that W against Michigan. Do you think the UC really came out with that final shot against Gonzaga in the final four?
It reminded me of, I think it was an AAC. I don't think it was the Big East. I think it was the AAC at this point. But an AAC game against UConn in the AAC tournament where somebody hit like just an insane half court three like that. I think it was in the semis or it might have been in the finals. That was just an absolute gut punch of a loss. It felt very reminiscent of that, but not really. And here's the difference. If it was classic vintage Cincinnati, I feel like somebody would have blown it or choked to lose it. There was nothing that they could have done better, in my opinion, that caused UCLA to lose that game. I mean, it was just Gonzaga got the ball last with apparently 3 seconds left, and that was enough for Suggs to hit that shot. So Mick said after the game that, like, you know, pretty much everybody was winners, and he didn't feel like his kids should feel disappointed. And I felt that way too. The commentators felt that way. Like, it was hard to fault UCLA for anything they potentially did. It was just, there was a few clutch plays from Timmy and Suggs that kind of, one, forced it to overtime, and two, won that game. So it didn't. That game did not feel to me like vintage Cincinnati heartbreak, where either some bit of bad luck or your team kind of shrinks at the end. It was just, you know, they didn't get the last touch of the ball.
Man, that makes sense.
Like, if I was a UCLA fan, it's hard because I was an objective fan, so it was like the perfect game for me. But I think if I was a UCLA game fan, I wouldn't feel bad. In fact, here's what I'm going to equate it to. I'm going to equate it to the Georgia-UC game. UC, while there are some questionable decisions at the end, UC really went toe-to-toe with Georgia, which was unexpected. And so from that standpoint, it's like one of those games where it's painful to lose, but you feel really proud of your team. Whereas UC losing to Nevada and blowing a 22-point lead in the tournament, that's just pain. That's just pure classic Cincinnati pain.
I see what you're saying there.
But then, you know, we had Baylor and Gonzaga. And I hadn't really watched Baylor all year. It's kind of interesting. I kind of want to go back and look at how often really what was considered the best two teams in the country ended up getting to face each other in the tournament. I don't feel like that usually happens. But
like Baylor just scenario, right?
Yeah, and Baylor just could not miss. They were on fire.
I was actually excited to watch the game, even though I didn't watch much of the entire tournament. But I know just from watching SportsCenter and stuff every day that Baylor was one of the best teams in the nation. And then you hear in the tournament that, you know, Gonzaga was the true number one seed, but then the next number one seed was Baylor. And they meet in the finals, so you're like two best teams in the country playing each other. Couldn't ask for a better matchup. Only thing you could ask for is that it doesn't start at 9:40. Like, oh, that's another God thing.
Yeah,
like, I'm so tired of these games starting at 9:40 because of the West Coast. Like, you already have good weather. Go fuck yourself. Watch the game at 4:30. I don't care. But the hype that I built up around it really fell apart in the first 3 minutes of the game when they went down 9-0, and it never even got close.
Yeah.
It wasn't it like a 10-point spread the entire game?
Like, yeah, Baylor never let go of the lead.
I think I ended up turning it on like midway through, and it was like a 14-point game, and I immediately flipped it back to the other. Like, I know a 14-point lead in basketball could change in a hurry, but like, I didn't think it was going to. And then
you never felt like it was going to happen.
And then I switched back like 10 minutes later and it was still a 14-point game or something close to that.
That was the entire game. It was always, I feel like Gonzaga was down 10 points the entire game. And to what you were saying, Sam, Baylor just could not miss. So Gonzaga could go down the court and put in a two, and then Baylor would go down the other side, not even make a pass, and just make a three. And now they're up another point. And that's just kind of how the game unfolded.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the closest I felt like Gonzaga scratched back was early in the second half. Like, by halftime, they got it down to 10, which was a big deal because they were losing by like 20. And then they got it to single digits early in the second half. And then Baylor went on like a 9-0 run. I'm like, all right, this game is definitely over. Baylor's just not slowing down. But how funny was it every time you heard the announcers say Timmy, the Gonzaga power forward with the Fu Manchu? Yeah. Every time, I just could not help but think of South Park and Timmy.
Jesus.
Man, they love saying his name. They could not stop talking about the dude.
Well, he was definitely a like a tourney favorite, especially on the Gonzaga team.
Yeah,
couldn't help but to hear about him, and then his Fu Manchu accentuated the whole thing. It was like that kid from Loyola Chicago with the mustache.
Yeah, that looked like a looking dude, 40-year-old man. At
basketball.
Yeah,
insane. Bringing back them facial hairstyles, unfortunately. I can't do anything like that. Sad, sad.
Well, it was definitely a weird season. Maybe I'll pay a little bit more attention next year, but I don't know, given the dumpster fire UC's program is. But I don't want to talk about that because that's sad stuff, and I'm hyped this week because this week's been awesome. We had that awesome Gonzaga UCLA game, and your 2021 World Series champs, Cincinnati Reds, are just on fire. I mean, how amped has the start of this season got you?
It's aside from the first inning of the first game, which I remember you sending a text message on opening day saying,
"Oh yeah,
it's the first inning and we're already down six runs." And it's kind of like, oh, here we go again, playing the Cardinals. Our best pitcher gives up six runs in the first inning. Like, could not get off to a worse start. And that being our only loss, they still batted extremely well in that game. But you can't ask for much better production in the first six games of the season. I think they have like 53 or 54 runs scored or something like that. Of the three teams that are 5-1, we had the most runs scored. So technically, we're the best team in baseball. And I know it's obviously a small sample size, but it has just been so fun to watch this team, just between obviously all the runs that they're scoring, how well the pitching staff has been, even though they don't even need to do good right now, and just the emotion that the team is showing. It just kind of gets you amped to, like, they didn't play tonight, and I was super depressed just because I want to watch them play baseball right now.
Oh, completely agree. Even though I can't watch due to that dumbass Valley Sports nonsense. That shit is unbelievable. But you can stream radio now on your phone. The 700 WLW games used to be blacked out. Now they're not. So I've had fun sitting outside in this nice weather and listening to the games.
Yeah, I pay for the MLB at Bat app. It's $20 for the season. You can pay more to watch games, but you don't get local coverage. So it wouldn't make sense for me to get that anyways because it would be blacked out. But yeah, I pay the $20 a month for or $20 a year for MLB at Bat, and you can listen to any broadcast. Yeah, for any team. So it's kind of nice.
Yeah, I mean, the amazing stat for me thus far is that in six games, the Reds have scored 23% of the runs they scored in last year's 60-game season, which just shows you how terrible their offense was last year. So, you know, obviously, we're going to see a regression at some point. You've got bit players like Naquin, like Aquino even coming off the bench, who are just killing it. India's off to a hot start. You've got to figure pitchers may figure him out a little bit eventually, and that should regress a little bit. But, you know, Castellano, you know, maybe this is more who he is. I mean, last year was definitely an aberration in terms of his production and where he can be at. So if this team can hit, you've got three solid pitchers in Malley, Gray, and Castillo. It's going to be interesting. They could make a push for the NL Central title. I still see them coming up a little bit short of that, and I don't think they're going to get a wild card, but I'm assuming they're not going to do it anything at the trade deadline. I think it's going to be interesting if they're a contender. Are they going to try to plug some of the holes at the back of the rotation and potentially in their bullpen? Because I don't know. It's going to take me a while to be sold on Garrett as the closer and just the bullpen in general.
Yeah, I'm with you. And Garrett already has one appearance, and it was a shaky one against the Pirates. Did lock down his first save, though, so that's good. Got that under the belt. But I like that you're also tempering your expectations with this team, even though they've gotten off to the hot, like the hottest start in the history of the team, because we know all too well what Cincinnati sports teams can do to us. So I'm trying to not get too hyped up for it because I'm with you. I'm gonna lower my expectations because there still is some issues that could arise because this team's not gonna score 10 runs a game every game. So what does happen when they really do get put in a losing situation where they have to have a bullpen guy step up, or they have to make clutch hits in the seventh, eighth, ninth inning when they're down runs? We'll see that throughout the season, but I'm really excited to get some of our other pitchers back. We'll see, when we see, you know, TJ Anton, who has a ton of promise, Michael Lorenzen, who is on the IL right now, who they talked about transitioning him to a starter role. I think he's still going to be more of like a long reliever or setup guy, but that remains to be seen. But I'm excited. Not too excited, but the ride's been fun over the first week of the season, so I'm just jacked about that.
Oh, yeah. When you're a fan of a team like the Reds, these are kind of what your season is made of like these little moments of joy. So, yeah, I'm going to enjoy staying excited about baseball. I particularly like being excited at the beginning of the season, too, because often in the past, the Reds have really gotten off to slow starts, and it kind of kills your enthusiasm for it. And that's the best time to be excited about baseball, in my opinion, is at the beginning of the season.
Right. And it's like I hear it every year. Like you just said, you got to get off to a quick start. And what was it, 2 or 3 years ago when we started the season 3-18? And at that point, you're like, the season's over. Basically, what can you do? Like you even getting on good hot streaks and runs and winning 4 or 5 in a row, putting yourself down 18 losses in 21 games, you might as well fucking fold up shop and call it a year. And that's pretty much what happened that year. But I remember talking about last season, you said what was it, 26% of the runs scored in all 60 games have already been scored in the first six?
Yep. Or 23, something like that.
Something like that. Okay, like a quarter of the runs, which is still insane. And there were things that I heard as well, just like a lot of bad luck that the Reds had last year. And I've said it on here before, where, you know, you smoke a ball through the infield, but you hit it right to the guy who was playing defense. And they did have some of that bad luck last year that you're hoping. It's not going to just turn into good luck, but you hope that you start to get a little bit more of those go your way, as opposed to, you know, they said, like, I think the stat I saw a couple games ago, it said like balls in play last year, they were batting like 232. And right now through six games, balls on play, they're batting like 320. So like they're getting extremely lucky right now. They're hitting the ball hard and putting it in the right places. But they did have some element of bad luck last year based off the statistics. And like I said, I'm hoping that kind of balances out and we see a little bit more production from the guys that we signed, like your Castellanos, like your Mike Moustakas.
Talking about my favorite stat.
What's that?
Babip.
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 Babip. Batting average balls in play.
Yeah, and it didn't help that we just were very inefficient offensively last year. But the balls that we did hit hard, it's just like, it's one of those where like you see
235 Joey Votto just very low for a team, Babip.
Right. Yeah. Right. Well, it's just like you see Joey Votto just like smack one and it's, you know, probably 90 miles off the bat and it goes straight to the second baseman and you're just like, what do you have to do? And I mean, you know what you have to do, but it's just like, there's gotta be an element of luck. You gotta, you know, if he swings that a quarter second later, that's a base hit. And they just were, you know, they're the beneficiary this year of finding those gaps and those alleys. Whereas last year they couldn't catch a break.
You know, what's funny though. You mentioned line drives where it just, you get great contact on the ball. You just happen to hit it right at a player. apparently Nick Castellano has led the league in that. I forget what the particular stat's called, but one of the analytics guys I follow posted this. He's led the league in that for four straight years.
That's so depressing.
It might just be something about Castellano and the predictability of where the ball goes when they shift for him, but you know, some of that may just be the players we got. But how excited do you think you would be right now if the Reds had managed to hold on to Bauer and Iglesias and you had this type of offensive production going on right now?
Well, that's the reason we have this type of production, because we had to lose really good players for the team to be like, all right, now we got to step it up. You know what I mean? But like if we had them, obviously we would be that much better. We didn't get better in the offseason when we lost Iglesias and Bauer. Those are two top-notch players, one from a closer standpoint, one from a pitcher standpoint. Obviously, Bauer won the Cy Young, had maybe his best season with the Reds last year. Went and got his money. Is what it is. Nothing we can do about it. We were never going to pay him $100 million over 3 years. But yeah, you kind of look at it like, damn, like we would, especially after these first six games with them, with those two players, I think they would have put us atop the NL Central, partially because I think the NL Central is very weak this year. But, with them on the team and with us doing what we're doing, I don't know how you couldn't make us the favorite.
But
Sure, and that's actually what put them, like, that's what, you know, all the analysts started putting them up top, was because they went out and actually made a splash signing, and they signed one of the best defensive and offensive third basemen in all of baseball. So a team that was already good got better.
Paid them to take him.
Yeah, that was such a weird transaction.
Best trade ever.
But I mean, but I'm hopeful that the Reds are actually going to compete this year. We talked about them being like number three, number four. Right now, we know the Pirates are going to finish in the cellar. I saw a stat today that the Cubs, their batting average is lower than starting NL pitchers' batting average right
now. The Cubs BABIP, Richard,
yeah,
is 132 right now.
Yeah,
terrible.
All starting NL pitchers are batting like 145.
I think the Reds' 245 batting average balls in play last year was like the lowest in the past 10 years. So the Cubs currently being over 100 below that is kind of wild, and obviously is going to revert at some point.
Sure.
So, I mean, right, we're very early in the season still, but the Cubs certainly don't look very good.
Right. And like you said, everything's going to eventually kind of balance out. And we're seeing the other two top teams are the Astros and the Dodgers, which is, there's nothing, you know, out of the ordinary about that. We're going to come back down to earth a little bit. You just got to hope that once we do, we can still find a way to pull out those close one run ball games that we just always seem to struggle with. And it, like you said, Sam, it's going to come down to, what's your bullpen going to do in pressure situations? What's your team going to do when they're not up 10 to nothing and, you know, just getting hyped when they're just hitting singles? What can you do when you're up one or you're down one in the eighth inning? Like, can you figure it out? And like I said, we'll see if that happens or if it doesn't.
I think the season should end now so that Baltimore can win the East and we can win the NL Central.
That sounds beast.
That the only stat we're going to talk about on this podcast from now on is BABIP.
BABIP!
Hell yeah.
All right, well, that's enough circle jerk into the Reds. I'm going to turn this pod over to you two, because another spring tradition is upon us, the Masters.
On CBS.
Yeah, dude. Nick, we're going to hear you talk more instead about just Babip. Talk to me how you're feeling about this year's Masters.
Well, apparently, round one in the books, it was very hard. Lots of guys struggled today. I believe there was only 9 players under par, something like that. 10 players.
I'll look it up, but you're pretty much right. There's only one player that actually did extremely well. Like a lot of guys, if they got off the course at even par, you heard the announcers talking like, "That's a good round for today with the conditions that they had." Apparently, it was nuts.
Yeah.
What was bad about the conditions?
Was it windy or something?
So it was windy.
I wasn't able to listen to any of today's broadcast, so I was just going off scores to assume that it was kind of difficult. But
I beasted my day today. I was home by like 1:45, sitting on the couch watching Masters, baby. But no, the wind wasn't like, it wasn't 20-30 mile per hour winds, but 10-15. And then on top of that, the greens were maybe the fastest I've ever seen them. You couldn't, where normally you watch most courses and you see these professionals, as they say, throw darts. They stick a ball next to a green. They put some sort of backspin on it or just sits 3-4 feet. These guys were hitting the greens 5 feet away and the ball rolled 60 feet. So with one, Augusta's greens are already some of the most difficult greens, at least in the U.S. And then when they're as firm as they were today, you can tell by the scores today that it makes it near impossible to putt on, to chip on, to drive, anything like that. And the players definitely struggled today, aside from one who was Justin Rose, who worked his way around the course. I watched most of his round. He was pretty magical.
I mean, based on what you're saying that you would have to be, it looks like he shot 6 under on the back 9, which can be a very hard back 9 from a scoring perspective a lot of times. Now I feel like Augusta's back 9 is a very give and take. You can either blow it all up or you can really post something nice. So that's, I think, part of why people like the Masters so much is that back 9 just adds so much level of variety. Like,
sure,
there's so many shots where if you go for it, it could cost you. If you don't go for it, if you miss hit it a little bit, it could cost you. Like, I've seen guys get birdies on 12s and then 7s on 12 the next day.
Sure.
It's just a wild tournament in general. And this year's shaping up to be the only thing I'm really disappointed about is Patrick Reed did pretty well today. And
yeah. It's funny that, like, I know that we both mutually hate Patrick Reed, and he was your 2018 Masters champion. And I always say that I love all the American-born players, but he's like the one that I absolutely cannot stand. But that's for a different time.
I think the entire golfing world can't stand Patrick Reed.
There's a whole lot of, like, whatever cheating in college and whatever that we could go on a whole entire rant about that. But back to, like, the Augusta. So this basically talking to you, Sam, because I know that you're not the golf guy here. Like, there's guys like Bryson DeChambeau who is taking over the game with insane distance. People were trying to model their games after him, trying to get the swing down like him, because he's literally turning par fives into par fours and par fours into chip on, get a birdie. Like, he's making the game so simple. On a lot of courses, you can do that. But at Augusta, it's kind of the equalizer, where you can hit the ball as hard as you want, but if you don't play accuracy, you don't put yourself into good positions, that course will chew you up and spit you out. And it did that exact thing to Bryson DeChambeau today. He shot 5 over par. If you go back and look at any of his missed shots today,
you could see 4.
Was it 4? Okay, last time I checked, it was 5. Regardless, he did kind of, for being one of the favorites this year, he did pretty bad. And you could see after like the first 5, 6, 7 holes when he was putting shots in the pine straw and in bushes and in the woods, he finally was like, I'm going to dial it back. I'm going to pull out my 3-wood. I'm going to try to play the accuracy game. It still didn't work out for him, but it's just like, this is a thinking man's golf course, and you have to play it a certain way, or like I said, you're not going to shoot well at Augusta National.
Now, yeah, I know about this dude, and kind of how he's changing the style of play. But to your point, like, is it? He seems like a really built dude. Is it a trade-off for a golfer between power and maybe accuracy and finesse? Or is this just like another tool that is almost like a superpower for him?
No, you can keep your short game skills. I mean, if you watch him putt, he's one of the most steady putters there is. He is a really... Bryson DeChambeau also puts a ton of analytics into his game. So he looks at like the best way to do every certain shot.
Ooh, I like it.
So
he's very in depth.
He has a different putting style than most other people. All his irons are the exact same length. So he swings them all the exact same. Which normally there's like, you know, 1¾ inch difference between every iron. So he thinks about the game more in depth probably than 90% of other players. Like, you could say Prime Tiger maybe thought about the game more, but Bryson puts all of his energy into perfecting his golf game. And his swing is crazy with the driver.
It is crazy.
But you'd be amazed at how accurate it is. And a lot of the times when he misses, it isn't that he misses left or right. It's he misses too far.
Too far, yeah.
He hits the ball through everything, and that puts him in a bad spot.
Right. And, so to Nick's point, he is still one of the best putters. He still has one of the best short games. That's the reason why he's like top 10 in the world, from a golfer standpoint, from a professional golfer standpoint. But so him being able to drive the ball 400 or whatever, you know, not 400, but 360, 370 to a guy's 320, he's making the course that much easier when he's hitting pitching wedge and the other guy's hitting 6-iron into a green. But like I said, at Augusta, it's exactly what Nick just said. That's what he's doing. He's driving through fairways and he's putting himself in bad positions. And that's really what's kind of been his demise so far. It's not a course that you can overpower. That's kind of what I like about Augusta.
What did Colin Morikawa win last year? The PGA or was it the US Open? I can't remember.
I think it was the PGA. Either one. It's not a big deal.
Well, what I'm saying is Bryson was doing the same thing in that tournament.
Right.
He was hitting his driver through every fairway. And it wasn't the way to play the course. It was because there's some places where you can hit it through and you're in the rough and it's fine.
In the rough, 6 inches. Yeah. That, like,
but there's
the course
other
you're talking
places
about
that you can't be in the rough. you can't be off the fairway because you can't get the, like right. Richard said, if the greens were as fast as he's ever seen them, you need to be able to put as much spin on the ball as possible. Well, yep. you can't
you need to be in the fairway.
Yep, exactly. You can't put as much spin on the ball from the rough because wow. you're not going to make as clean contact. Blades of grass and stuff are going to get in the way. So. Sure.
Well, and it didn't matter what kind of spin they put on the ball, how well they were in the fairway. You had to play a different kind of golf today, and it was a lot of like you had to hit the ball short and you had to let it run on. And that's tough, too, especially when you're playing against the wind. And it really showed on the course today. I think I just looked it up. There was like 12 players who shot under par. And the aside from Justin Rose, who was the anomaly, who shot 7 under, the next best score was 3 under. And then like even like the best, the guy who won it last year, golfers golf number one player in the world, shot 2 over today. So that doesn't mean he's out of it, but it's tough if Justin Rose can go out and shoot a good score tomorrow. What's nice about golf, though, is like, so the course firms up throughout the day, obviously. Sun comes out, gets warmer, so the course gets drier. So the guys who played in the morning today, who had the kind of better conditions, will have to play in the evening, or, you know, in the daytime to evening tomorrow, and vice versa. So the only thing that's wild is Justin Rose played in the evening, so he's going to have those good conditions tomorrow. So I could see him, as long as he doesn't have some sort of have the jitters for being in first place, I could see him shooting another good score going into the weekend.
At this point, is there a score that would be like, it's highly unlikely you're coming back from that? Like, is DeChambeau's +4?
Well, I mean, so half the guys won't make the cut. So that's the big thing for tomorrow. And the cut line moves based on top guys' scores. So they'll be looking at a certain line tomorrow. DeChambeau is going to have to shoot better than – he's going to have to shoot a couple under tomorrow if he wants to make the cut. Because once the cut happens, half the guys are out of the tournament for the weekend. So yeah. He's going to have to shoot better. Any of the guys who shot over par are looking to try to get into red figures tomorrow and try to make the cut.
See, that'll be interesting tomorrow. That'll add some drama because I was trying to watch today and it was just boring as hell. Boring as hell because there are too many golfers kind of golfing simultaneously. So the broadcast is always switching back and forth. They're showing shit from like the future, or not the future, but like the past, and then moving back to the future, and then like going from hole to hole. Like, there's not any consistency. I typically watch on Sunday because sure. at that point, the narrative is down to typically a few guys chasing one another. They're focused in on those guys. It's going back and forth. The drama's great. But today, because I don't know anything about, you know, most of these guys or really care about them, it's just like, I'm just going to put on some baseball highlights and watch that.
No, that makes sense. And for the longest time in my life, I've played golf since I was 10 years old, but for the most part in my life, I have could care less to watch golf. I got into it about 3 or 4 years ago. So I've been there with what you're talking about when I, you know, show up on Easter with my family and my grandpa was watching golf, and I've golfed with my grandfather before, but it's just like, I don't know how you do this shit. But it's like any other sport. You take a liking into it, you start to like guys, you start to hate guys, so you start to cheer for stuff, you start to cheer against stuff. And this is really like I said, this is my favorite tournament of the year. It's what I feel like honestly kicks off spring, even though we've already golfed a bunch this year. It really does kick off the golf season. So I get super jacked for it. And I told you, I got off work early today, plopped out on that couch, and I could not stop watching it. Just cheering for certain guys. Like I said, if you don't have a dog in the fight, you're not going to care. So I understand your perspective on it as well.
Dude, my dog in the fight is Hideki Matsumi or whatever his name is.
That's Hideki Matsuyama?
Now. Matsuyama, yeah. Matsuyama's my boy now.
Alec chilling for Woy McElroy.
Hell yeah. All right, Richard, so we might have to wrap this up right now because I got a text from Nick saying he can't hear me anymore. Nick, can you hear me?
No.
Nick, are you there?
Uh-oh.
Well, you know what? I think that's a good place to end the pod. Yeah. We will, Scout's honor, have you guys do a dick pic, send it the group text, and then we'll recap it next week. I want each of your golfers and whoever gets the best score, since it's unlikely that you'll pick any one golfer who will win. Whoever gets the best score by Sunday will win the dick picks. And you will get to go first as a reigning champ.
Sounds good. Yep, because I picked out Dustin Johnson back in November.
All right. You wanna take us out, Richard?
I got this. If you out wrangling chimps, you probably got Jade's. Butt stuff.
Butt stuff.